Get started. So, I'm charged to go forth and give you a lecture on pain today. This is Pain 101, Basics of Pain Treatment. Please, of course, feel free to stop me at any point, ask questions, and afterwards I will have the information put up on the website, and I'll probably just email around my slides anyway in case people want to just look at them and read them or whatever. So, let's get started. In overview, we're going to hit some key things. The pain med myths. I like debunking medical myths, or at least I like ones that have been debunked. The basics of pain medications. Conversions. Starting medications and titrating them. And some miscellaneous issues at the end that probably spend only 1 minute on. Things we really can't cover today because there's a little bit more intricacy to them, and maybe they're for a Pain 102 lecture, would be PCA pumps, injections and spinal meds for certain specific conditions, and then treating specific diseases, because there are many specific diseases that include pain where we might treat them differently based on studies that are done within that specific disease. This is more of a global lecture about using pain medications and treating pain in general. Of course, at the end, if we have time, you can ask whatever questions you want about those. All right. So, pain med myths. The four we're going to touch on are the sphincter of Oddi, Demerol versus morphine. You're going to cause respiratory arrest and kill everyone. You're going to make everyone into an addict. And the fact that physician oversight and regulations means you can't give pain medication to anyone. So let's start one at a time. Sphincter of Oddi. We are not rabbits. Damn it. Great. Now that's recorded for posterity for the future. Yeah. I have to be careful not to curse now. Yeah. And the reason I say it like this, I didn't realize it was blue based on a blue background because I hadn't given a talk in this room, I'll change that for the future, is because there's always this idea of if you have gallbladder pain, something to do with the sphincter of Oddi, you can't use morphine. So all the surgeons and other people tend to say you should use Demerol. Those studies that originally looked at the sphincter of Oddi to see if morphine had an effect on it, to see what effects pain medication had, in, were done in rabbits. And I think there was one done in a cat. Seems a little cruel, but whatever. I'm not a big cat fan, so I don't really care. And when you actually look at the data in humans, it makes absolutely no difference which pain medication you use on its effect on sphincter of Oddi. So that's all just, you know, wrong. Feel free to use anything, pain medication-wise, on somebody who has sphincter of Oddi or some sort of gallbladder issues. It has nothing to do with anything. For that matter, I specifically don't use Demerol, but I'll get to that probably another slide because it's just not a very good drug. All right, second myth or thing that's said that's not always incorrect, respiratory arrest. The overall concept is, first, for the most part, you've got to relieve pain before you're going to cause sedation, before you're going to cause respiratory depression, before you're finally going to kill somebody because they just stop breathing completely. And for the most part, from what I see in most hospitals I've been in, not that I'm that old, but you know, the places I've been to, we're not even really getting past this in most cases to properly relieving their pain well too often before we're even possibly getting to some of these. So my point overall is not that you shouldn't be careful. Of course you should. You should know what you're doing before you're prescribing these things and titrate appropriately. But that we should be much more focused on the idea of relieving pain and much less worried about killing someone because we're not even getting, this is dying, not even getting past their pain relief point to have to start worrying about the other issues. Next, addiction. So there's some terminology to make sure we understand here. The first term is tolerance, so which has to do with you need to increase the drug or the dose of the medication to get the same effect. And now that's very common with probably almost many things we use. For instance, the coffee drinker in the morning who drinks one cup of coffee for years and really is by the afternoon or late morning already now needs a second cup of coffee or one of those bigger, huge, you know, cups that now everybody uses from Starbucks because it's really like three cups in one. And you're getting a little bit tolerant to the effects of caffeine or the alcohol, the person that needs to have the third beer to finally get a little buzz because the first beer just doesn't do it anymore. Those are all examples of tolerance, and same with the pain medication, same with morphine and other things. That's not meaning that you're addicted. It's two different issues. These are terminology issues that we're just wrong on. That's a tolerance to it. That can happen physiologically and is, in a sense, normal based on your own physiology. Physical dependence is where if you withdraw that medication or whatever it is you're using, that's wrong with it. You get a withdrawal reaction. Many patients who are on chronic opioids, chronic pain medications, do become physically dependent, so that if you withdrew it quickly, they might have some withdrawal reaction. That does not necessarily mean that they're addicted to it, and if you had to get somebody off of it, then you would. You'd probably just do it a little bit slower and get them off if they were on high doses of something, get them off over a period of days, weeks, sometimes even months if it's a large, large dose. But it's not really addiction. These are other physiological aspects that can happen with using these medications. The last point on the slide, psychological dependence. This is what really is addiction, where there's an overwhelming involvement with getting that drug, medication, whatever it is, and that it starts to interfere with your function. So I'm leaving my job as program director in the afternoon to go score a hit down the block in the Bronx for some more cocaine. Not that I do that. Again, being recorded, got to be careful. So, this is something where it starts to interfere with your function in your job, in your family, in your hobby, whatever. Some aspects of your life it's starting to interfere on. You're getting arrested, you're getting fired, you're getting divorced because whatever. It somehow has started to affect you and you're trying to go out of your way to get it and it's not allowing you to function properly. Those are the people that are addicted. So now that we have that terminology down, you're not going to be addicting everyone. The studies are actually pretty clear that people with chronic pain that you have to put on medications for long periods of time, weeks, months, years, usually with chronic it's months to years, that very few of them actually get addicted. They get these other issues, tolerance and physical dependence, much more frequently. But very few that have real reasons for chronic pain are getting addicted. Very few. So, all right. Third issue. Oh, right. There's. I throw this in right here because there's sometimes a misunderstanding where, and especially of knowing what pseudo-addiction means, where the patient says, I need more, I need more, I need more, or they're coming back early for more, or it just seems like, this person keeps wanting more and more and more, they're addicted to it, or they're abusing it, or they're using me, they're playing me to get more medication. And while, of course, that can be true, and you've got to be careful with everything you're doing, which is why I suggest that anyone you're going to have on chronic opioids in your future practices or wherever, that you get them on a pain contract where you have them sign a specific set of things, the rules they're going to go by. They're only going to come once a month. They're not going to call for refills. They're not going to make sure that they're doing things exactly the way you say, so you keep them in line. But a lot of times, these people that are coming back and looking addicted, looking like they're using you, they're pseudo-addicted, which means that their pain has just never been really fully treated properly. So, of course, they're coming back a little earlier because they're using up an extra few pills. Or, of course, they're telling you their pain is a 5, you only got it from a 7 to a 5 every time, even though you keep titrating up. It's because nobody's quite titrated up to the level that will finally get it to a 2, and they can be fine and function all day. Whichever of the reasons within that, somehow it's a not fully treated pain. And it looks like addiction because of that. So it can be tough to tease out. It really can be. I try to start, because I'm just that kind of person, from the perspective of believing everyone, house staff or patients. And you have to see if they're really proving to you that they are abusing it in the end, or that they're not doing things according to your rules of using opioids, that you just say, you have to stop, we can't give you anymore, and maybe they're really addicted, or maybe they're just using you. But for the most part, I start from the perspective of maybe this is a pseudo-addiction, and see if I can work on the titration to an appropriate level where I really think it should be working by now, and try to get them treated. All right. That fourth one, we already kind of mentioned some of these things by using contract, a pain contract people call it, to make sure they don't have loss of control of their use, to document if there's any adverse life consequences that's causing addiction, indication of drug-seeking behaviors, drug-taking reliability, so if they're taking extra doses, not using the meds as you prescribe, again, that should be part of your contract, that they have to use it the same way you prescribe, they can't just double their dose on their own or start using a PRN on top of it. Abuse of other drugs, obviously, you should be asking for it every visit to look for this, and of course, that should be written into your pain contract, that absolutely no tolerance will be there for the use of anything, heroin or cocaine, or and probably even doing spot checks of urine. And that's built right into the pain contract, that they have to agree to do a spot check of urine anytime you ask, or you cut them off, because then they're probably abusing other drugs, and it's not acceptable. Contact with drug culture, and cooperation with the treatment plan, like we said. All right. The last of those four myths or issues are physician oversight and regulation. So everybody feels like, if I use too much opioids to treat patients' pains, I'm going to get in trouble with the government. And it's actually the opposite, in a way. Yes, you have to document what you're doing properly if you're going to use medication. use the pain contract. Document in each follow-up note that you've asked them, what is it on a scale of 1 to 10, where 1 is no pain and 10 is like you got hit by a Mack truck and you're about to die. I actually use that literally, because if you don't give them some sort of point of reference, they'll not know exactly how they should judge their pain. But anyway, the point is, yes, you have to document all these things that you're looking into each time, or doing your urine test, or doing whatever it is you're doing. But as long as you do that, you're not going to have any governmental trouble. And there actually is now at least one lawsuit on the file, and there probably have been several since then, because I only looked that up years ago, where a physician was treating an elderly patient who is chronic pain, end of life, totally undertreated the pain. The family was very upset. Patient died finally, and sued the physician for just not taking good care and treating her pain at the end of life. And they won. So the pendulum is really swinging in a sense that you are expected to, especially as internists, whether you go into a subspecialty afterwards or not for the residents in the room, or even as a student, if you go into other fields, if you're going to treat pain at all, which many fields involve, you should really know what you're doing, know how to document it, and be pretty aggressive about getting people control, especially with chronic pain, and make it part of the standard. Some people are referring to pain as the fifth vital sign. I kind of personally hate that, because it started to be that everything has become a fifth vital sign. The O2 stat gets presented as a fifth vital sign. But the point is there, that it's important, and there's just too much pain, and we need to work on it. All right, let's move on to other things. This is a picture of my daughter. She's not addicted to alcohol, but we have to be careful, so I monitor her intake. Okay. The mild narcs. All right. So I kind of divide these up, and you can probably tell that I just got asked to do this lecture an hour ago, because on the list of the mild narcs, oh, it's on the second slide of the mild narcs, there's actually still Percocet and Vicodin on it, and there was just a new ruling last week from the FDA, I forget exactly who put this out, that they're going to force those companies to redo Percocet and Vicodin and things like that, to take out the Tylenol component of it, because too many people are having Tylenol overdoses. So you're about to see a shift. I don't know exactly the timeline of when that's going to happen, but look for it in the newspapers and in the medical journals, because you're going to see a lot about that coming up. Anyway, the mild narcs, codeine, pretty much codeine and propoxyphene are your mildest narcs out there. It's almost always used in combination codeine. It's like Tylenol number 3, as for instance, is Tylenol with codeine. Tylenol number 4 is just the same thing, but with more codeine. The biggest problem, of course, is that it tends to be nauseogenic. Nauseo, I don't know if there's a real word for that, but it causes nausea, codeine, in a lot of people. So a lot of people just won't tolerate it. But if you need some minor something that Tylenol is just not helping, you know, sometimes I'll just kick somebody up to Tylenol 3 for a week or whatever, some short period of time for their, you know, serious stubbed toe or whatever it happens to be that's very bad. Generally, it's 1 to 2 tabs POQ4 because it only lasts the effect of at most 4 hours, and you don't want to go higher than the allotted Tylenol dose, so that's the rate-limiting part of any of these combination drugs is always the Tylenol component. 10% of people, though, lack the enzyme to even make it active, and then those people, obviously, it does zero and just makes them somewhat nauseous. Propoxyphene, also extremely mild stuff. I personally never use it. It's in Darvocet, and I think there's another one, Darvan? Anyway, I just rarely use it because it's so mild. It does like almost nothing. Tramadol, heavy marketing on this because it's a newer drug, so it's under, patent? Thank you. I'm already getting senior moments, but since I'm younger, it's a junior moment. So it's much more heavily marketed, and they'll tell you it's good for what ails you, and that it's not addictive, and that it's not really an opioid, and they're mostly just trying to sell their product, which I understand. They need to sell their product. It is an opioid. I don't necessarily believe it's no more addictive, that it's any less addictive than any other opioids. Strength-wise, the one study I've ever seen seems to say it's probably about as strong as Tylenol number 3. So, to me, it's pretty much just expensive Tylenol number 3, because Tylenol 3 is generic and cheap as all heck. But if you're going to use it, and some patients swear by it, so, you know, I have used it sometimes. It does have a ceiling. It's one of the few opioids that have a ceiling. And that would be 400 milligrams, as it's listed there. So, okay. They now have an extended release version of it, though. I did put it on there. Okay.
Does it cost a high if people abuse it? Like, is there abuse potential for abusing it because of secondary...
Yes, any opioid will give you a high taking
it. Since they market it as not being I was just wondering.
Yeah, for the most part, these pharmaceutical companies are fantastic at massaging the data. And I believe, as a good internist should, nothing they say until I see it in a study published in a peer-reviewed journal. Hydrocodone. This is what's in Vicodin. Oh, so it wasn't the bottom slide. Stronger than codeine. This is probably the strongest on this list. Used with Tylenol, again, not for long. There are a couple of companies that put it out. So Vicodin, Lortab, same stuff. I think there's even a third name for it. And it is marketed with ibuprofen as Vicoprofen. I don't know if they're going to have to change that one. I think they're only changing the ones with Tylenol. There are a lot of different preparations. So just know how much Tylenol is in each one, because each company is making it a little bit differently. So until you're really comfortable with whichever version you like to use or you find helps or whatever, I look up every time. I suggest that for every medication. When I was house staff officer, I must have looked up every single drug, you know, 10, 20 times until I finally remembered how many milligrams of each thing was in each pill I was prescribing. So, oh, there was only one slide for the mild narcs? Oh, okay. For some reason I thought there were two slides. The heavy narcs. So, morphine, hydromorphone, and oxycodone. Morphine is kind of your prototypical one. It's been around forever. It's pretty much dirt cheap. Even the extended release forms have been around long enough, they're cheap. So I tend to use this more than most other ones. There's a lot of different dosing. I'm not going to read through every single thing on there, only to point out that there's some very long-acting ones, the Cadian and the Avinza. Avinza being the longest, I believe. It's once a day. Yeah. There's the ones that are, they call them long-acting, the morphine, MSER, morphine sulfate extended release. MS-Contin is the trade name. I only call it somewhat long-acting because even though it's marketed as BID, there are a good cadre of people, probably a third of people out there that take it, that the effect wears off by 8 hours and they kind of need the TID. And then it can actually be difficult to get the pharmaceutical, not from the managed care company or whatever it is you're dealing with, to pay for TID, because there really has only been studied officially and marketed as BID. So just know that. You may have to finesse and get the person on TID for some of those people. And of course, short acting, it only lasts for 4 hours anyway. And there are preparations that can be opened up, spread on food for people that can't swallow. So you have a lot of different versions of this you can use. Hydromorphone, dilaudid is the main way you've heard of that. It only comes really in 1, 2, 4, and 8 milligrams. This is much stronger, milligram for milligram, than morphine. And it really only comes as short-acting. I think they had a long-acting version for a short time. It's now only available in Canada. I don't think it's available here still. Oxycodone, which you've probably heard of as OxyContin, the long-acting version, is OxyContin, is in the news a lot as a drug of abuse. It's kind of one of the key picks for the street value. It's about $20 a pill in case we're... No, don't go out there. We are in the Bronx. And if it's crushed and used like that, so you get the entire extended-release pill in a very rapid, snort, shot, whatever, you can easily, that's where you get the overdose, sedate them, respiratory depression, and killing somebody. So people using it as a drug of abuse like that can get themselves in real trouble with the extended release. But most of you frequently use it probably as Percocet with Tylenol in it, or with the aspirin as Percodan, much less commonly seen used. And the Percocet, like I said, will probably be going away, or at least the combination with Tylenol will be going away. The other, heavy narcotics, fentanyl. This is one of my favorites just because it comes in a patch, and it's, I think, the only one still that comes in a patch at this point. And they actually added a 12.5 milligram one, so that was nice. It used to only be 25, 50, 75, 100. So you can really kind of titrate in a way. Strictly speaking, what you should probably do, since the patch is very long-acting, so even if you gave them the 12.5, let's say, and you didn't really know their needs, if it was too much, because let's say the person's just really opioid naive, and you rip it off, it's still going to take 14 hours to come out of the system completely, because it was a slow, absorption thing. So you really, what you should do, strictly speaking, and not everybody does it, but what you should do is pick a different narcotic, titrate them to control on that, and then use the charts for conversion milligram for milligram to figure out how much of the patch that would be, and then move them over to the patch. But a lot of pain specialists don't do that anymore. They just start with the 12.5 and move on. Okay, let's see. It did come out as a two other versions. Actic is a lollipop that you just suck on, literally, and gives you transmucosally some dose of fentanyl. I don't remember the exact dose. I put it on here. Yeah. And up to four times a day. So it's like the breakthrough version. And they most recently, I think it was just a year or two ago, came out with Fentora. Haven't seen it used yet, so I'm sure some of the pain specialists do. Which is basically a very acute release buccal droplet. So you just put it right in there and it's just right into your gums, your buccal mucosa very quickly. Just be careful with lollipops. You don't leave it on a table where kids visit the patients if they're very sick, because it really does look like a lollipop. I mean, it sounds like a joke, but if the kids lick it, they're in trouble. It's very strong stuff. That's why it's in micrograms, if you notice. Methadone. So also been around forever, nice and cheap. You have to be careful with this. It can be used for pain, not just for replacing heroin as a methadone maintenance program. If you use it, I would write on the bottom of the script, for pain, because you don't want the government seeing methadone. This person's probably methadone, probably it's for methadone maintenance. Let me look them up on our list. We don't have this person credentialed to do methadone maintenance because you need a special license for it. And then they get you in trouble. As long as they see right on the script for pain, they know you're not looking to do it as methadone maintenance, and they just move on. You know? So I would just specify on the bottom just to be careful for your own sake. But you can use it for pain. It works very nicely. Many people need it four times a day, though, for pain. I've seen it used twice and three times, but really, from a half-life perspective for specific pain needs, it's really four times a day. So in that sense, it's not so great, you know, taking pills around the clock like that. And of course, you have to be careful of issues like QT prolongations for prostate. So I would look at the person first and make sure it's the right person for it. Oxymorphone is now available again. You know what? I think this might have been pulled from the market again since I adjusted this slide a year ago. So let's not even comment on it. I think there's a chance it was pulled off the market. Something's ringing the bell. It might have been pulled off the market. I didn't get to update the slides. I just found out I was giving the talk an hour ago. Basics. Okay. So on to the next section. So pain, I mentioned before about, you know, the 0 to 10, and really give them an anchor point. Otherwise, everybody walking in is an 8, 9, or 10. Because, what, they're going to tell you it's a 3? I mean, who wants to be the yutz who walked in to see the doctor with a 3? No patient's going to say that to you, or very uncommon. They're all going to tell you 8, 9, or 10. So unless you get a real idea, and then that way at subsequent visits, you can kind of see, well, last time you told me you were at 8, you know, from 0 to 10, where 10 is like a hit by a Mack truck. Now, where would you say you are? And sort of document every time to see if you're getting somewhere. Chronic pain doesn't wear the same face. So I say that as a sort of a picture way of saying that the acute patient, the person lying there on a stretcher with an appendicitis, which if you look it up in the book, I don't know if we have it in the back of the room here, of physical diagnosis book by Sapira, The Art and Science of Bedside Diagnosis. To me, it was one of the most interesting physical diagnosis book. He shows you a picture of a person lying there with appendicitis, right? I think it was disease. And the person has this look on their face of like this, like you can tell they're in pain. I'm not doing it well, but that's an acute pain, and you've seen that all many, many times. You've made it many times. But the chronic pain patient has had it for weeks, months, years. They walk in and look fine. They sit down. They tell you about their kids. They want to know how you're doing. You say, how's your pain from 0 to 10? They tell you it's a 9. And you're sitting there thinking, you don't look like a 9. You can't think like that for the chronic pain. You don't keep reacting like this for, you know, 10 months in a row. It doesn't happen. We get used to it, and then you can function, but you're still in a lot of pain. So you have to still believe them through that. Again, starting from the position of try not to start from disbelief. Like, you know, believe what they're saying if you can. Acetaminophen, generally it was 650 for fever people, and 1,000 milligrams was when you're using it for pain, the two extra strength Tylenol, as people frequently use it. Some companies even came out with this really high one, the 1350 up to three times a day instead of 1,000 up to four times a day. There's been a bit of a backlash against this. Again, just in the last few weeks. And it's now starting to be suggested, I just saw in the literature, we even use the 650 for pain. And that it's probably is just as good. So I just throw that out there. New news, this just in. And so it's pretty much all equally efficacious as long as you're using equivalent doses. So like, for instance, the COX-2 inhibitor medications came out and the companies were saying how strong they are for pain and how this, and again, just got a good strong as naproxen, which costs a cent a day if you use the appropriate amount of milligrams for each one of them. And of course, be careful, oops, just go back for one second, about high doses in the elderly. I'm actually very careful. I try not to even use them at all in the elderly if possible. It just raises your blood pressure, gives you kidney issues. There's like 10 different ways it hurts your kidney. Some nephrologist once told me all 10. I'm not smart enough to remember all that, but it's amazing how many ways this can destroy your kidney. I try to use it for prolonged use if I don't have to. Obviously, people with peptic ulcers need to be very careful, and with excessive alcohol intake, it's a setup for GI bleeds. So just, I would be pretty careful. I try not to use NSAIDs. I almost go as far to sometimes even picking a mild narcotic instead of an NSAID. Just, there's less side effects, less problems with it. I obviously have to be careful with who I'm using narcotics on, but it's actually safer in a lot of ways. Ketorolac is that only injectable NSAID, but it's up to only 5 days because of its just strength and toxicity by using it in that kind of dose for such an acute setting. Sometimes used like that for migraines, something like in the ER sometimes. But don't forget to add, if you're using some other, let's say, morphine sustained release twice a day, 30 milligrams twice a day for somebody with chronic low back pain from osteoarthritis for the rest of their life, add Tylenol or NSAIDs to it to augment it. So you can use the 650 of Tylenol three times a day at breakfast, lunch, and supper on top of the morphine, and you'll find frequently it keeps even better control, or that you don't have to titrate the morphine up as much as you would have expected because of this kind of synergistic effect you can get from Tylenol and NSAIDs acting with the narcotics. This makes our lives a lot easier, that the narcotics are all written on the same kind of script as other drugs. Back just a few years ago, even in New York, you had to write regular medications on one kind of script and narcotics on another kind of script, and all this craziness, triplicates. You know, thank God New York finally did one smart thing. And every script is the same for every single patient. Here with the electronic medical record, it just gets printed out. Other hospitals, they don't have it. It's just one script pad, and you can write anything on it. So that's nice. The only problem is you can only give out 1 month's worth if it's Schedule 2. Excuse me. Schedule 3 narcotics. I think I flipped this. Schedule, let me just tell you briefly. Schedule 1 are things that are like illegal. You know, cocaine. You can't even prescribe it. Schedule 1. Nobody has a license to prescribe Schedule 1. Schedule 2 are what I refer to as those heavy narcs, the oxycodone and morphine and all that kind of stuff. It's kind of one of the reasons they are in the heavy narc region. That's Schedule 2. Schedule 3 are those milder ones, the Tylenol 3s and the Vicodins and Percocets and all that kind of stuff. So I think I flipped it here. The Schedule 2 ones, you can only give 1 month's worth. You're not allowed to use the multiple months' worth on it. While Schedule 3 ones, if you put a proper reason on the script, what the chronic illness is that they have, you can actually write for refills. Up to 3 months' worth. Demerol, most immunogenics, like codeine, it makes you vomit a lot, so I tend to not use it just for that reason alone. But also, breakdown products give you seizures. I think you all know that by now. It's one of those common things on the boards. Don't really use it in chronic pain patients. It just doesn't even do a good job. It lasts about an hour or two in most patients I've ever asked, and in most studies I've ever seen. So why are we writing, because these injectable ones are Q3, oral ones are Q4. Why are we writing for Demerol Q3? We're basically prescribing for these people that about half of their 3 hours, they should be sitting there in pain. It's just kind of silly. Pick a different drug. It's just not that good. All right, let's move on. Morphine, oxycodone, just said that. Q3 if they're sub-QIVIM. But if you're using PO, these are Q4 because of the way the absorption is orally. When you're converting between pain medications, start the new medication at between half to two-thirds of the total dose of the original medication because of this incomplete tolerance. So if I had somebody titrated to morphine 60 milligrams twice a day, it's extended-release morphine, so it's twice a day, and I decided for some reason, maybe they had a side effect, maybe they couldn't buy it because their managed care company wouldn't give it to them, whatever, that we had to move to oxycodone, extended release, the OxyContin. I would first figure out what the ratio is for the proper, it happens to be 3 to 2. So 60 of morphine is the same as 40 of oxycodone. That's one of the only few things I ever ask people to remember is 3 to 2 there. And then the 40 of oxycodone, I wouldn't give that to the patient when the switch. I would actually go down to a half to two-thirds of that. So I might give them, you know, 25 or 30 of oxycodone, or 20, something like that. Between 20 and 30 of it instead of 40. And then only if it really didn't work, then titrating them back up to that 40, that exactly equivalent dose. Because they may not have the exact same pain reaction to the equivalent doses. So whenever you're switching between them, drop a little bit, and then you can always kind of titrate back up over the next week or so. No ceiling, I think I mentioned before. You just had the only ceiling is if it has Tylenol in the medication. Always start patients on anti-constipation meds. That's probably, if I had to tell you one thing today to take back to the ward, that's probably the biggest one, but hopefully it'll take away more than one thing. Just don't even wait for them to come. They're going to get constipated. Unless they're only on for like a day or two for some hyper-acute issues. Just start them on something for the constipation. And then probably not just colase. Something that really moves bowel along. Maybe Senna, maybe Bisacodyl, whatever, something. Because they're going to get constipated. All right. Conversions, you don't have to remember it all. Like I said, you can always just sort of look it up on computers, Google it, up to date. You know, I'm sure there's plenty of resources you can find it. The only one I tend to remember personally for quick reference when I'm seeing patients is this 3-2 that I just said between morphine and oxycodone. The other thing, there's two numbers I tend to memorize. These 3-2 there. And since I tend to use morphine most frequently, so it's nice to have a familiarity with it, when you're switching from PO to IV, or IM or sub-Q, it's 3-1. So those are the only things I tend to memorize. And I'm not good at memorizing stuff. I'm sure there's some geniuses out there in the crowd. You can memorize Harrison's. You know. I've never been Harrison's memorizer. Certain key things you must know, and everything else, know where to look it up quickly. This is the kind of thing you should probably remember, those two things. So anyway, the rest of them there. This is heroin, just for reference. Please don't use that. And there's one other thing, is that people don't always realize that one Percocet is the same as 2.5 milligrams of morphine. Not oral, this is the subcutaneous. So when you're giving somebody, you know, they come in the ER with pain, and somebody gives them two of morphine. I keep hearing two of morphine. That's not even one Percocet, whereas someone who comes into your office, frequently we give them two Percocets POQ4 for that 2, 3, 4 days worth of pain they're going to have from whatever, they got their tooth pulled or, you know. We're not even giving them that when you give them two milligrams of morphine. You're giving them less than one Percocet. I'm not telling you to go out there and be hyper-aggressive and give people huge doses. Just know when you're giving them way too little from the get-go. You know, at the very least, if you're going to do that, come back in 10 minutes and say, did that do anything? No? All right, let's go to 5. You know, get somewhere quicker. You know, don't spend a day on 2 milligrams of morphine. All right. I don't want to go over, so we'll try to get through this. Fentanyl, again, I certainly didn't memorize this. I just figured out how much they had in the last 24 hours of morphine. So they had 350 milligrams in the last 24 hours. I see that falls in here. I put on a patch of 100. But remember, incomplete cross tolerance. So maybe I would go to the 75 patch. And then if it really didn't quite work, bump it back to the 100. All right. This is my other daughter with an extremely large bird on her shoulder. Next. So starting medications, morphine, tend to pick 5 milligrams. I know we mentioned the whole 2 thing. Even 10 milligrams sometimes with very, very severe pain or people that are a little bit more tolerant or whatever. And that's Q3, remember, because we're doing it IV, sub-Q, or IM. If you're doing a PO, frequently 15 to 30 is the starting dose. Remember that 3-1 ratio that we just mentioned. Double the baseline if there's no effect. This is scary. You give somebody 5 of morphine, has no effect, go right to 10. This is standard teaching for all the pain, you know, specialists, the pain residencies, the pain, everything. This is what you do. So what I would suggest, what frequently has, unfortunately, because we're all so busy as house staff, I know, you know, how busy you guys are. You write an order, here it's in the computer, for 5 of morphine, sub-Q through Q, 3 hours. And then you go admit 14 other patients because you're busy out of your mind, and 12 hours later, somebody's finally by the patient's bedside and say, so did that do anything? If you're going to give something and you're not sure at all how it's going to help them, stop back in just for a minute, 30 seconds, about 30 to 60 minutes later. By the way, did that morphine kick, did it do anything? If they're saying, yeah, it did something, it wasn't perfect, okay, fine, you know, you don't have to double. But if they're saying, you gave me morphine? Yeah. Just double it. I mean, it's over. Go move right on up. You know, we take way too long to get people control. Let's see. Breakthrough medications. So usually, except for just very hyper-acute, quickie pain issues, you're ordering something as the standing medication. So let's say that 60 Q12 of the extended relief morphine that I mentioned before, and a breakthrough medication. So the person might use just that twice a day, but let's say they tell you once or twice a day I get breakthrough pain, and it pops back up from the sitting at or the two, it pops back up to a 7 because of I'm sitting in traffic on the Cross Bronx, and my low back starts to kill me in that way I'm sitting in there, and I just need, you know, something for that once a day that I'm on the Cross Bronx. You know, whatever it is, there's some breakthrough reason. And they should have a something else, about a quarter of the dose. So a quarter of the 60 milligrams would be a 15 milligram tablet of the short-acting morphine to use as the breakthrough for that, hopefully 0 to 2 times per day. If they're needing it more than twice a day for breakthrough, it's already time to figure out how to up the dose of the long-acting one so they don't even need the breakthrough anymore. This is kind of, these two points are extremely key to overall just treating chronic pain. Any questions? I'm either being so clear that I should win a teaching award, or you're all asleep. I'm hoping for the award, but... All right. Similarly, for the people on the inpatient side, you can use an elixir. So it's like a liquid morphine. And then you can really subtly titrate, you know, by like 1 milligram. You know, so you have somebody on 5 milligrams of morphine sub-Q, Q4 hours for their pain, but you just saw this person admitted. You don't know if 5 milligrams is really the right dose. You don't want to wait 24 hours to sum everything up like you do in an outpatient setting. Maybe wait a week or a day or whatever. Here, the person's in this acute, terrible pain. You can write for the 5 milligram sub-Q, Q4, about Q3. For sub-Q, it's Q3. And you can write a separate order for morphine 1 milligram, sub-Q, Q1 hour for the breakthrough, PRN. Now, I've got to tell you, the nurses will hate you for anything Q1. And they'll scream at you, we can't do Q1s on the floor, you can only do Q1s in the unit, you can only... You're not going to be doing... The guy's not going to be asking for Q1 for the entire next 24 hours. If he is, you're doing something totally wrong with the much longer-acting version of it. But strictly speaking, whether the nurses kill you or not, you can do this. I mean, this is a reasonable way to handle acute pain where you still don't know how much they really need to help them. Sort of touched on this, that let's say you have someone the extended-release morphine for 24... to switch them to... So if I had this person on the 15 that I just said of oral morphine, well, let's say it was the 5 sub-Q Q3, and they used it every 3 hours, the entire first 24 hours they were in the hospital. How much did they take? That's 8 times Q3 hours times the 5. They used 40 milligrams. But remember, 40 milligrams of sub-Q multiplied up by 3 to get the PO is 120 of PO. So if I was going to convert that person into just an oral long-acting, for instance, if I, for some reason I want to do this, I would be giving them 120, split that in 2, because morphine sustained release is twice a day, I'd be giving them 60 BID of sustained release morphine. Yeah? We okay on that? Okay. I said that before, and, right, I mentioned that the first, though, I mentioned that when you rip it off, it still takes a good 14 hours for the residual of fentanyl to stop. And even starting it, that first 12 hours after you put it on, it just doesn't have much effect at all, almost nothing. So still keep giving them something for that first 12 hours. All right? We're getting there. We'll be done on time. Let's see. If they come in as a long-acting, remember to give them something for the breakthrough. Either Tylenol 3, Vicodin, lower type Percocet, sustained release, immediate release morphine, Actique, blah, 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 using about 10% of the long-acting dose. Find out how much breakthrough they used at every visit, right? That's your way to know if you need to be upping the overall dose of the long-acting. Okay, keep going. Miscellaneous. So yeah, last section of our talk. For the elderly, consider using things like hydromorphone and oxycodone, since there's no metabolites. Careful on renal insufficiency, specifically with morphine and tramadol. I don't even use propoxyphene, so that's a non-issue for me. So for persons on X milligrams of morphine, and they the long-acting morphine, every 12 hours, and they come into the hospital, and now they can't take pills for some reason. They're obtunded, or you intubate them, or whatever. Some reason, pills are not an option. So what do you do with this? You can't just stop it dead away. They'll go into withdrawal. You'll get confused, because now they're having tachycardia and sweating. You think they're having an MI. You basically take it and convert by taking a third of the 2 times X and making it into an IV drip to be used over 24 hours. And 2 times X means just because this is Q12. So if they're on that 60 we said before, so 2 times 60 is 120. Take a third of that. Now we're back to the 40 milligrams that we said before. Remember when that person was on 5 milligrams and they used it 8 times? I'm sort of working backwards from the same example I used before. I'm glad I picked the same example. And you can either give that as the 5 milligram sub-Q, Q3, or you can convert it into a drip of every hour. That would be like whatever, 1 to 2 milligrams in an hour of a trip. Radiation therapy, we're not going to obviously talk much about this, and things like injectable radionuclides, bisphosphonates, can sometimes help with bone pain specifically, and tricyclics, sometimes also duloxetine and a few others, but probably this is the more classic one, can be used for certain types of neuropathic pain. I've had a lot of success with tricyclics for leg neuropathic pain and for migraines and prophylaxis, so we don't have time to talk about this. I have a whole different headache talk I'll give you guys another time maybe, but think about tricyclics once in a while. Last slide, I think. Lidocaine patch, sometimes used, way overused. I mean, sometimes people give this again for what ails you. It's like everything is lidocaine patch. And I think people do it because they don't feel comfortable with narcotics. And they feel like they're going to get themselves in trouble. I don't know how to use narcotics. Let's just give them anything else I can think of. Tylenol, lidocaine patches, whatever. Anything but narcotics. Lidocaine patch has been studied in very few indications. The post-herpetic neuralgia was really almost the only one I found out there. So, you know, you have other things you want to try it for. I would look it up. I would at least be honest with yourself that there's not much data on it. I would be honest with the patient that you're trying it, but if it doesn't work, let's stop it and try something else. And I would still think about using narcotics if it's going to be a long-acting pain, a chronic pain in that area. Topical things, I rarely use capsaicin cream for some neuropathic pains. Again, it just depletes substance P in the area. So sometimes for post-herpetic neuralgia, once it's crusted over, you can use it. You can't use it while it's open. Some people have used it for osteoarthritis. Sometimes lidocaine and prilocaine creams for certain kind of cutaneous anesthesias. Not fantastic, but, you know, in a pinch, you can use it here and there. Clonidine can be a nice thing to add, usually add, to another medication for sympathetically maintained pains, sympathetic nervous system pains. Steroids, sometimes for vasogenic edema and pain in the spinal cord areas, especially if there's fractures back there. Dextroamphetamine and methylphenidate, occasionally. I've used it rarely like this, just maybe twice, 3 times I can think of. For people that wind up somewhat sedated on their opioid, you can use this early in the day, 1 dose breakfast, 1 dose lunch, no dose, you know, supper and night, to sort of get them out of sedation so they can still tolerate the opioid because they really need it for terrible chronic pain of cancer or whatever, something, and still get them functional. So it's rare, but use it once in a while. And occasionally, when you need naloxone because somebody did get overdosed or you think they might have, just be careful, dilute it down and give it 1 cc at a time. If you give somebody a good, huge dose of naloxone that's on for chronic cancer pain, some decently high dose of morphine or whatever, and you just totally blast and block everything, they're going to have this horrifying pain for the next, you know, whatever, several hours to longer sometimes. And it can be difficult to then treat that because you've blocked so much. So just, you know, maybe take it a little bit slower, especially if people have been on high doses. And I think that was it. Yeah. So if we're all a little careful, we won't make these dumb mistakes when we're using our pain medications. I just love this one. Yes, it's classic. There's nothing else, right? Is that the last one? Yeah. All right, any questions, thoughts, anecdotes, comments, or short stories? Short story?
What to do with this difficult patient that we usually see in the floors that you don't believe that they are in pain, but they have this opioid-seeking behavior?
Yes. I'll start from the position of why do you think that they're lying?
Often visits.
Often visits, like they're admitted frequently? Because you're talking inpatient.
Very often, yes, and you are trying to search what is the cause of the pain, multiple tests, or has been negative and you didn't find anything.
Is this somebody with an underlying condition? Because if it's somebody like a sickle cell patient,
no, it's not sickle.
I frequently hear, like when I was in Westchester, you know, they say, oh, you know, she's a frequent flyer, she doesn't really need it, we shouldn't give it to her, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, with sickle, I got to start from believing those people. That's a terrible disease to have with pain. I mean, that's like the definition of having a lifelong pain is getting a sickle. So I tend to start from believing those people. Now, having said that, even one sickler, or with labeled a sickler, we said, not sure I understand this. The hemoglobin's not as low as usual for a sickle. We did the hemoglobin electrophoresis, decided this person was lying about their sickle disease in the first place. Different story. But depending on the underlying protoplasm, you have to make a judgment call. So if this person's coming in with abdominal pain, and you've had them in-house 4 different times in the last 2 months, and you've done your CT scans, and you're this, and you're that, and the GI console, everybody's purpling in, you're going to start to wonder, is this person, you know, trying to just go for narcotics? And I would say to that, A, narcotics are not a great idea for abdominal pain in general. because they tend to give you a lot of masking. There's A, the constipation that happens with it, so you have more pain, and you're not sure which one, you know, what came first, chicken or the egg. And B, you get narcotic bowel syndrome sometimes, so it doesn't move properly, the bowel, and then you wind up with pain from that, and again, it confuses. So most abdominal pain I don't even give narcotics unless I really have to for some very specific reason. You know, ischemic bowel that we already diagnosed, and it's just continuing abdominal pain for several days, and you need to give them something. You know, fine, obviously, you know. But I tend to not even give it to them. If you have somebody where their abdominal pain and you've worked it up four times and nobody's figured out, have we at least sat down and talked to this person about could they be having psychosocial stressors, and this is all somatic complaints because of anxiety and stress and depression. You know? My point is I can't give you an answer for every circumstance. Every single person you see with some kind of pain and you guys can't find a reason or you think it could be somebody abusing it, you have to take every single circumstance a little bit differently and figure out, is there a real reason to believe this person? Or is there anything I can do to think out of the box about what else could this be? Because there's no one-size-fits-all for pain. You know, it's so individual. I know we have a pain service here. I believe Dr. Sidlow and a couple of other people are involved. What I saw at Westchester Medical Center was the pain service actually being pretty overused. That the house staff and even the attendings, I hate to say, didn't necessarily feel like they had enough familiarity with a lot of the narcotics. Almost any patient that had some pain, I'll just call a pain service. Or maybe they were so busy with how many admissions they had a day, I just call a pain service. They don't want to think about, you know, how to deal with it. And like I said at the beginning, we're all going to be internists, or the students in the room, even if you're going to other things, you're going to be someone who probably has to deal with pain patients at some point. You should have the fundamental working knowledge of the things I went over in here to basically handle 90-95%, probably even more really in an outpatient practice, of what pain comes in. And only those few really more intricate ones, the PCA pumps and this and those, call the pain specialist to help you out and learn from them. Anytime you call a consultant, learn something from them. So the next time you have to call less times about what you learn from these people. I know that was a really long answer that in a sense didn't even answer your question, so I apologize. But if you ever want to run a pain case by me, catch me. I just happen to like the area. I'm no big expert. I didn't do a pain fellowship or anything. But I've always felt more comfortable, I think, than many of my colleagues with it. So, you know, certainly feel free to kick me in the leg once in a while and say, what do you think of this? Yeah. It's no problem. Yeah.
We had a patient earlier this week who we had never seen a doubt of pain, but she was had opioid addiction, was on methadone maintenance. Do you treat that differently when...
She had, say it again,
She had legitimate pain.
From?
She had atypical pneumonia and this like throat infection and this headache that was sort of a chief complaint. It was just, you know,
okay.
Acute pain.
Something that related to the acute scenario.
Yeah.
And on top of that was on methadone for maintenance from heroin. From everyone I've ever talked to, I never really read a lot about that specific circumstance. For every pain medication specialist I've talked to, basically the way to handle it is keep doing the exact amount of methadone that they're getting. And we are allowed to prescribe that while they're in-house as their methadone maintenance. Still call the program, make sure what they're on, find out how many milligrams, then just give them that every day, once a day. And separately give them whatever the heck you want for the pain.
Okay.
For the acute pain. Yeah, so just pick something else, just not to confuse it. Pick morphine, pick Percocet, pick it, whatever. And just use that to titrate for whatever pain they need, and then as they're leaving the hospital or as they're feeling better, titrate that down and off, and they still leave the hospital in the same method. Just separate them.
There's no difference in titration or dosing or anything?
Not really. I would, personally, what I always do is use on the Hippocrates, like a multi-check, to make sure there's no interactions with various things I'm giving. But I do that for things having nothing to do with pain also, just because I'm trying to be careful. Were you about to jump in there?
Just with that, I mean, do you ever just increase the methadone?
I personally don't, because again, it just starts to confuse that issue of, are we, someone who doesn't have a license, to do methadone maintenance? Because it's a special license you have to apply for and get trained, and am I now looking like I'm titrating up somebody's methadone maintenance to the regulatory bodies? Am I confusing the patient, maybe, with what they're going to leave, or because they should go back to their old dose? And to be perfectly honest, in a perfect world, in a perfect world, there wouldn't be a methadone maintenance in the first place, but in the perfect world of people who need methadone maintenance, really, it shouldn't even be maintenance. It was originally thought of as get these people on it, get them back to being functional humans in society and this and that, not using, you know, heroin and whatnot, and then titrate it off. And it just never seems to happen. Everybody sort of stays on it forever. And maybe that's has to be for now, just because there's so many people that would go back to crime or this or that, and then maybe this is the better, the lesser of two evils, is just to leave them on it forever. I don't know. Whole different discussion, I guess.
Are you So the issue is with methadone regarding the prosodic ones of this recent arrhythmia. It has been right now an article that was interest in analysis internal medicine regarding this issue on the care and the follow-up of the EKG. But also, this week, all the letters to the group were mentioning that be careful with all of that because some people can think that we need to suspend the methadone and all of these issues. But more than that, it's important is follow other issues that can be affect the risk for malignant arrhythmias in this patient. Check electrolytes, check medication, be more careful because they don't have enough information, but maybe other causes could be the contributing factor to these articles that were mentioned, the EKG follow-up.
Was there a question in that?
No, it wasn't mentioned.
Good, because I missed it. Your point is great.
It's not only check EKG, it's only...
Your point is great, I just read this article.
...in other factors that can increase the risk for arrhythmias, but
electrolyte disorders specifically. I agree with you completely. I did read this article. It's just recent. So
yes,
a couple months ago?
2 weeks ago.
2 weeks? Yeah, that is an excellent point. Yeah, absolutely.
Is it contraindicated to use NSAIDs in a patient with renal risk factors in an acute setting? I mean,
renal risk factors or renal disease?
I mean, hypertensive and not the renal disease. So you're going to use it for an acute pain for a week, for instance. You're not going to use it.
As long as their hypertension was controlled, I give it to them. If they had 160 over 100, I don't give it. I give them something else. Because it doesn't raise it a huge amount. It's not like you give an NSAID and it goes up 50 points or something. And it's more of a population issue. If it brings it up even just 3 or 4 points, if you do that to the entire population, you have an extra 5% of people getting chronic kidney disease earlier in life. You know? So it's more of a population issue. But if it's not well controlled, it's a little bit harder to defend than if it is well controlled. So I do give it to people below 140 over 90 if I need it acutely.
For acute pain?
Right.
Can you
chronic, I try to give it to almost nobody if possible. I just think it's a bad idea.
And what is your opinion on dipyrone, a drug that is...
On what?
Dipyrone, I don't know if you know.
Dipyrone?
It's a drug that is used in South America.
Oh, I guess I don't know this
one. But not here because of agranulocytosis.
We don't have that in the United States because the risk with the aplasia, bone marrow. I knew that it was planning to perform a study about that medication for pain in South America, a big study, because they were thinking that maybe this risk was not so high, but at the end, some areas in a few countries, some hospitals doesn't want that. In the United States, you don't use that.
Let's stick to what's available in America. Any other last comments? All right. Let's get out there and treat some pain.